Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. Now, in this episode, I speak with Brett Kelly, who is the CEO and founder of Kelly Partners, an Australian-listed accounting business that he has really built from the ground up. And I actually got the chance to meet Brett earlier this year over in Omaha, Nebraska at the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting. Brett was one of the very first people in line at something like 3:30 or 4 a.m. in the morning for the Berkshire meeting, and we were standing right behind him. So we got to speak with Brett and the CFO of Kelly Partners, Kenneth, at that Berkshire meeting, and we went away from that conversation feeling like we'd acquired an MBA in about a couple of hours. It was a great conversation with Brett and Kenneth, and I think you'll get a real feel on this episode for who Brett is as a person and as a business builder and leader. Now, I did go into this episode with quite a long list of questions about, you know, how KPG came to be, how the business is structured, you know, what future growth prospects look like, how Brett thinks about capital allocation, and I had quite a lot of audience questions kind of ready to go as well. But this episode ended up being a lot more about just business and life more generally. Of course, we talked about kind of the come up story for Kelly Partners, but it didn't entirely go in the direction I had anticipated. And I'm kind of happy it went in the direction that it did, to be frank. Now, I think a lot of people are really quick to praise, you know, successful business people. And Brett is certainly one of those people. He's built Kelly Partners from nothing to the place where it is now, and he's been a very successful business person as a result. So I think people are really quick to praise that, but they don't necessarily appreciate some of the struggles that can go into building those businesses, particularly early on. And Brett shares some of the struggles that he and his wife Beck kind of went through in the really early days of building KPG, and does actually get quite emotional at one point there. So I really do hope you enjoy this episode. Quick note before we get into it, I believe this is the very first time I've had a public company CEO on the podcast. So just bear in mind that this is purely for education and entertainment purposes only. If you're ever looking to invest in any company, whether it's Kelly Partners or not, please do your own due diligence and make your own decisions before obviously making an investment. But with all that said, let's roll the episode, and I hope you enjoy this one with Brett Kelly. Brett Kelly is on the podcast. Brett, thanks for taking the time to join me for this one. How's things with you?
Mate, things are fantastic. It is always a great time to be an accountant if you've got a bit of energy.
That's good stuff. I've got lots of things I want to talk to you about today. But I think before we get into it, I mean, we met in person earlier in the year in the line at Omaha, I think at about 4 a.m. or something like that. I know you've been a big Buffett fan for a long time, and you got a pretty good looking Buffett cutout behind you with the KPG hat on. So what was that trip like for you? How was the Berkshire experience?
Oh, Tom, it was good to meet you at 4 a.m. I think we were the first there, actually. And
just about.
Yeah, front door. Literally, I think we were the second there that were behind two other people, which was great. Bright and early with Ken, our CFO. Look, quite an emotional experience, really. You know, in life, people are either examples or warnings. And, you know, I was very lucky at 22. I lost a job. So I'd started at Pricewaterhouse at 18 as an undergrad accountant. I then joined an investment banking corporate advisory. It was the top independent corporate advisory group in Australia at the time. And I lost the job. You know, I was told I didn't fit in with other people, which is probably true. And Dad gave me a couple of books, How to Win Friends and Influence People, Think and Grow Rich. Interestingly, later after promoting, you know, those books in terms of the role they played in helping me, you know, get out of this tough situation, I did the Dale Carnegie course. They gave it to me for free. And, you know, I was reading, I first read Philip Fisher's book of Common Stocks and Uncommon Profits when I was, I think, 17 or 18. And it's that led me to Buffett because, you know, he had written a comment on the book, or somehow the sort of breadcrumb trail took me there. But, you know, and Warren had said, like, hang around people that make you better. You know, when I lost this job, I read these books, read a book a week, I bought the whole Simon & Schuster self-help catalog of tapes, and I made a bookshelf, and I think it was hundreds of tapes. And I just listened to them continuously while I was working on my book for the next 6 months. And it was a sort of full 12-month project to get it done and published and in the market. But what was really interesting, it was all about, you know, you end up the average of the seven people you spend the most time with. You're number one and there's six others. So I made this choice that through books in those days, I could just hang around people that had changed their lives. I learned through writing my first book, Collective Wisdom. So 34 prominent Australians on, you know, telling me about Australia today, the future and what had made them successful. I came to consider that these were people that had learned how to achieve their goals. So I wanted to learn how to achieve my goals. I didn't know what they were. I didn't really know what I was really uniquely good at and where I should spend my time. And so in meeting these people, they helped me realize that you have to find the thing that you're really, basically in my conception, put on the planet to do, where you can really make a difference, where you can take your gifts and talents and basically help other people. That's where I decided, after reading of, you know, nearly 3,000 books over the ensuing 7 years, writing two books, really what life was all about, you know, what, in my view, growing in wisdom, which is deep understanding. So who you are, what your gifts and talents are, and where you can make a difference. So Buffett played a really big role in that, as did other people, you know, people like Mandela, Gandhi, etc. I wrote about them in my second book, Universal Wisdom. It had Buffett in there, and Nelson Mandela, Gandhi, Mother Teresa, just people that had found their thing and had done their thing to the best of their abilities. And so Warren sort of met that criteria. Often people, they talk to me, you know, because most people in the financial circles are completely fixated by numbers and spreadsheets. And so they can resonate when I, you know, share that I think Buffett's been a huge influence. But, you know, just as much has been these other people like Mandela and Martin Luther King and these guys. I'll share why that is. But specifically, Charlie Munger is somebody that I relate to even more than Warren Buffett. I notice your Almanac book behind you. I've got one here, got a couple actually. And the reason is that Charlie was a lawyer and he met Buffett and, you know, he started Munger Tollers, as I understand, in California, grown that. Buffett said, look, you're never going to become super wealthy as a lawyer. He started investing. So I really related to, and still do, Charlie's path. I'm not as, you know, naturally, you know, I'm less agreeable than Warren is. And so I relate to Charlie, who I think is more disagreeable than Warren. I'd like to be more like Warren in terms of my communication style and that, you know, that as much as anything might have something to do with age. But I do, you know, very much at the Berkshire meeting, I'm sitting there. It was very emotional, frankly. I'm sitting there watching these guys who have been enormous mentors and teachers to me that I've never met, right? They're like my virtual friends, you know, your imaginary friends. And I've read every word. I've watched every YouTube. I've watched things over and over again because, you know, you become the people you spend the most time with, and why not choose the best to learn from? So that's been the journey. What I learned was that the people that they have attracted are so much like the people that resonate with me. They're readers, they're lifelong learners, they're actually interested in life as well as and as much as they're interested in business. They're ideas people, because in my view, it's ideas that change people and it's ideas that change the world. And so it's really the intellectual journey that you know, is what drives me. I'm, you know, dominant strength is learning. And what I've tried to build at Kelly Partners is a, you know, essentially a social service organization that wants to help people stress less about their money, employ more people through their private businesses, and be better people first and better business people, because I don't believe you can be a great business person without working on the person that you are. And that's what we try to do with our people and help them do that with their clients, so that ultimately there's a flywheel of positive influence on people. And so when people ask me, you know, what have you learned from Warren? I believe he has this flywheel of values and behavior that is compounded financially because the finances are an outcome, they're not an input. So that's classic Bezos, you know, focus on inputs, not outputs. I've been focusing on, you know, mission, values, and vision, and then into clear strategy and structure, and then the operational things that drive a business. So, mate, long answer to a short question. I met you guys, I met a bunch of great people. I love people, which distinguishes me from many accountants. I want the best for them. I want them to be the best they can be. I believe in people. I know that my own journey has been so heavily influenced by the contribution other people have made. You know, I wrote to Buffett in, I think it's 06 or whatever it was, and he wrote back to me. I have a book here. He wrote a letter back to me. And, you know, other people are like, well, what's that all about? And I'm like, look, at the time, I was pretty down and out. I was a young guy. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was smart, but not focused on, you know, the difference I could make. And in, you know, July 26, 2005, thanks for your nice letter and books. I'm returning the book you requested to be autographed. You know, I sent him Warren Buffett Way and he autographed it. Sent it back in the reply paid envelope, sent me this beautiful letter. However, I can't help you on your other request. I'm cooperating with Alice Schroeder, who is working on a book about me, and therefore regularly I decline interviews from other authors. You know, and he wrote The Snowball with Alice Schroeder. So to me, that's incredibly special. And if, you know, to understand my own journey, essentially, if I meet you and you're rude and you're not deep, you don't want to read, you don't really want to understand the business and who we are and what drives us, I think, well, Warren Buffett was very kind and polite and very gracious to sign my book, write it back, and, you know, and put these words of encouragement, you know, at the end of the letter. Good luck to you in all of your endeavors. You know, so if he can treat people like that, then to me, that puts us all under pressure to behave better, to encourage other people. And often I've found in my own journey that certainly the people at the very, very top, that's how they are. And many others are peanuts who have a lot of commentary and not much grace. So, you know, incredibly gracious to meet, you know, to meet him via the letter, because to me that was a personal letter. It was amazing to get to the meeting, met so many people, but it was life-changingly special again. And the biggest thing I got, interestingly, was you can be amazingly engaged with your life and business for a long period of time, and the real return is the relationships, the standing ovation that he got when he walked on that stage from people that appreciate the way he's looked after them. And then I went out into the trade hall where I saw this grab bag of businesses. And at a hard commercial level, I thought to myself, now, wouldn't it be great to have a massive trade hall like this where we're the permanent partners of hundreds of accounting firms globally, and that we can line them up in the order with which they joined us, and that they can tell their unique stories and the way that we've helped them and looked after them. And I don't actually need to go outside my circle of competence. I don't need to have cowboy boots and overland vehicles and, you know, jets and SUVs and all sorts of things. I can just have accounting firms that I believe can make a massive social contribution in terms of helping people be less stressed about their money, be on top of their businesses, employ more people, and really essentially change the world, because 70% of private businesses, 70% of all Australians, and I think this is true in New Zealand, the US, the UK, Canada, most of the developed world, are employed by these private business owners who mortgage their houses, take the risk to take on the responsibilities of leading a business. So, mate, huge for me. Like, really could not have been more inspiring and solidifying in why the journey is worthwhile. It is very difficult to build a business, and it takes an enormous, you know, 24/7, at least a mental and emotional commitment. I think that's not always recognized by people. We're not in this business to spin it up and sell it. We always wanted, you know, built to last. Jim Collins built a 100-year business. What would be required to do that? We've given every person that's joined Kelly Partners since inception a copy of Good to Great, and raving fans. You know, we're just trying to do something different. So, you know, that very much helps to build that internal resource that you need to you know, fight the fight and push on. It also gave me the global perspective of just what's possible at scale. And frankly, I got to meet investors of ours from Finland, Sweden, Switzerland, Germany, the UK, the US. It's like a little Kelly Partners meeting, which is pretty special. I was lined up for the run. I had my Kelly Partners hat on, which I'm prone to do very often. And a guy from Texas came and said, "Oh, you Kelly? Yeah, yeah. I said, you look like your photos. So that's helpful." I said, "Well, to a degree." He said, "Oh, I bought some stock. I love your company." And we had a 20-minute chat before the fun run, right? So, you know, I'm in business because I love people. I really care about them, want to make things, you know, better for them and their families and, you know, the people we interact with. And, mate, we're never going to get that perfect. That's okay. We're not anxious about that because we accept that we're not perfect, not even close. We look at businesses like Apple and Walmart and Macca's and Four Seasons and Ritz-Carlton and these Berkshire and think, well, that's a bit more like what perfect looks like, which keeps you humble. And, you know, humility is kind of the master of all virtues and the only thing that's going to drive you to continually learn. So, you know, I often get comments, you know, you're too promotional about the business. I started the business from scratch. I sold every first client, sold 750 grand's worth of new business in 3 months. If you walk past still today, I'll ask you, do you have a great accountant? And if you don't, you should join Kelly Partners. So kind of who I am. Love it. You know, I get this sort of commentary, you know, Brett drops names. It's true. I just talk about all the people that have taught me everything because I didn't do anything myself. Okay. I believe in finding great role models, great mentors, even people that have massive warnings and say, don't be like this, be like that. I just believe that you learn with and through other people. So, you know, in the spirit of what I'll share, I'll just talk about what I've learned and who I've learned from, because I don't claim to be the author of really any or many big ideas, because I don't think there are many. And I really just don't think there are many massive ideas. So I feel like we're all co-authors of, you know, the good things we do.
Very cool. Yeah, I echo everything you said about the, just what it was like to be in that, you know, in that arena, I guess, at the Berkshire meeting. The atmosphere was just unbelievable. I don't know if that's what it's like every year or whether it's because it had kind of been a couple of years with COVID and everything between people getting together. Yeah,
Tom, it confirmed what I've always believed. People are more similar than different. Their DNA is the same. Everywhere in the world, there were people in that room from everywhere in the world, but they could recognize in this, you know, in this pair, but in particular in Warren, somebody who's, you know, determinedly focused on being who they are, run their inner scorecard, even when people give him a hard time and say odd things about them. He is odd, right? He's not the same as everyone else. That's okay. Thank goodness for that. But that's resonated cross-culturally. There were people in that room from age of 10 to 100 from every country in the world virtually. So it just solidified to me that these, you know, great businesses are an exercise in deep meaning around deep mission. What is it that you feel uniquely qualified or called to do in the world? What are the values that resonate with everyone? So there can't be many. For us at Kelly Partners, it's people for others, people that keep their promises, and people that know that teams can achieve more than individuals. They are just our big three. That's how we select our people. That's how we review our people. That's how we select our clients. That's how we select the community organizations that we get involved in. That's what animates the business. And so I've just been to the US. The average EBITDA in a US accounting firm pre-partner REM is 18%. The average EBITDA in our firm's pre-partner REM is about 45%. So these big ideas drive financial returns that are nearly three times the industry average. It's not some spreadsheet. It's not some trick. It's not some, you know, funky Brewster business. It is the fact that we bring people into this organization that share our mission, share our values, and share our vision of what's possible. Yes, we've created a clear strategy. Private business owners, they make the most difference in society commercially. They employ 70% of all people, and they keep their accounts on average for 50 years, in my view, on average, right, if you do a great job. They want to keep multi-generational service providers like accountants and lawyers. They'll be with you forever if you're with them, if you have their front door, back door, side doors, their back. Then they can feel your passion for caring and looking after them as people as well as business people. So, yes, we've got all these other things. We're great at people and process, and our client offer is unique. We've got a clear financial model. We understand risk and we aggressively manage it. We have a fantastic digital solution that we're continually investing in and building. We're great at brand, you know, but not compared to Apple, certainly compared to the industry generally. We have a clear mandate of how to grow organically, how to grow via acquisition. We know how to do succession, and we're working on how to do that globally. So we say there's 14 parts of business. These are the 14 parts. We have a solution. We've systemized, we build, blah, blah, blah. But unless you get the right people, as Jim Collins would say, see, there's another name drop. There's a bloke. He's taught me so much. Never met the guy. I don't know the guy. He's never emailed me, but I've read every book he's written. I've underlined, highlighted, and watched his videos. It feels like some guy I know. I don't know him, to be clear. I wish I did. But to the degree that I've been able to get near his ideas, which is near him as far as I'm concerned, I've enrolled in every course he's ever done that I can get near or can pay for at the time if I had the money. He's taught me so much. And he says, get the right people, right? It's those people. Boris Groysberg, a professor from Harvard. I did the president program with YPO 4 or 5 times. And he talks about your top 10% of people drive 90% of profits. He's another guy who's written a book called, I think it's called Managing Stars. He's an amazing guy. Look him up on YouTube. These are all people that have mentored me, inspired me, taught me things. And I've tried to gather a group of people around us, and it's those people. And so, you know, when people say, well, hey, Brett, what happens to Kelly Partners if you're not there? Well, I don't know. Maybe I'll take 5 years off and you'll all see. These are amazing people in our group of great values who share the mission and the vision of what we're trying to do. And I'm incredibly proud of them. The only reason I'm speaking to you today, Tom, is I believe it's in the interest of the company. I believe it's in the interest of my people for me to do what I am uniquely good at, which is explaining our business. But frankly, it's 8:30 in the morning. You know, I've been out for my walk. I've been to the gym, had a workout. I've had a swim. It's a beautiful sunny morning in Sydney. I could be, you know, I guess playing with my dogs and talking to my kids. But I do believe it's in our interest to, you know, share the KP story. And the fact is, KPG story, fact is that we've attracted, as you know, what Lawrence Cunningham would call quality shareholders. And by the way, I just bought his book and did everything that he said. That's all, nothing too secret or scary about that. And we've got this fine group of people from all over the world. And I love hanging out with great people, so I'm happy to share the story and attract more great people. If the share price goes up or down in the short-term voting machine, long-term weighing machine, we're cool with that. We're okay with that. We're trying to build a really incredible business over a period of time.
Cool. And we should say Lawrence Cunningham, I believe, is on the KPG board now, which is very cool to see.
Yeah, quality shareholders newsletters, Tom. Somebody in Spain sent it to somebody in the US who sent it to him. He read it. He researched the company. He reached out by email, said, you know, would you like to have a Zoom? I'm like, yes, of course. Had a Zoom. We got on really well. He could see, you know, he's got an academic background. He could see that really my conception of myself is that I'm just a student of life trying to grow in wisdom essentially and apply it, execute it at a radical level. And that resonated with him. And, you know, he's a wonderful guy. He's been a real mentor to me. And I'm trying to learn everything I can from him about Constellation in particular in Berkshire, how to do decentralization better, how to empower people to step up and grow the business, and how to be a better leader and better person, you know.
Incredible. Yeah. Well, Brett, tell me a little bit about, I'm interested to hear about the very early days of KPG. I mean, your story's been out there about, you know, being unemployed, you know, tracking down very successful people and writing a couple of books. I believe self-publishing it, correct me.
Yeah, so Tom, I lose my job, you know, I'll say it quickly for people, but just lose my job, didn't know what I wanted to do, read 2 books. One said, find people have been successful. I found 34 out of 80 prominent Australians. I was in outplacement with Morgan Banks in Sydney. I got the Who's Who little book, find all their addresses, just anyone I wanted to meet, Rupert Murdoch, Kerry Packer, I never got to interview them, Paul Keating, Bob Hawke, John Howard, just asked everyone, Jeff Kennett, H.G. Nelson, the comedian. These are all Australians. I wrote to them. I'm Brett Kelly. I'm 22, unemployed, keen to learn. I've got 11 standard questions. If you give me a time of day for an hour, face-to-face, I'll interview you, put it in a book, get it out to other young people, give a bunch of the profits to charity, which I did, and publish a book. I learned that everything you want to do in life, you do through a team. Everyone told me I was too young, no experience, no expertise, blah, blah, blah. Had no money, couldn't do it. I solved those objections with a team. I found people that had experience, expertise, that had money that would help me. I raised the money. I've spent my whole life savings, $50,000 in 1997 dollars on the book, because I believe learning was more important than buying a property. I could have bought an apartment, I think, for $199,000 in Balmain at the time. Anyone who knows what that means is worth over $1 million now. Would have got a 20-time return on that money. I've done better than that on investing in myself, as Buffett says, because I'd read Buffett. He says, if you're going to invest in anything, invest in yourself. And sorry to keep mentioning him, but that's where I got these ideas. They all say the same thing. All the people that have done things say the same thing. Invest in yourself. Learn how to speak. Learn how to write. Learn how to do spreadsheets. Learn how to do marketing. Learn how to recruit people. Learn how to do everything. So I self-published the book, which taught me how to find a typesetter, find a proofreader, find a PR agent, find a distributor. I talked a distributor into distributing it. We distributed it. It was a best-selling book in Australia. I sold all the books in 3 days. I got it on the highest rating show in Australia, which was A Current Affair at the time. It was like Larry King in the US. And we sold all the books. So didn't know what I wanted to do. Did at that time hundreds of professional speaking engagements. I've now done, I think, about 2,000 of them over the ensuing years, which made me good at communicating, you know, that story and, you know, what we're on about. And I went back into chartered accounting. I believed, I read this sermon from the 1800s, which, you know, a lot of speakers, like motivational speakers, reference, called Diamonds Under Your Feet. I was like, why am I here? I'm in tax. I feel accountants don't care about their clients. They care about the technical work to the exclusion often of the clients. I did a master's of tax. I got my tax agents. I worked through three smaller firms. Those were private businesses where the owners were busy thinking about themselves, not about their people. My mate was stuck in a terrible partnership up in the Central Coast. His name is Scott Elwin. He still runs our Central Coast business. He's my longest serving partner. Really, the reason Kelly Partners exists was my wife and Scott. Scott came to me and said, Brett, help me get out of this partnership, start a business. You have 75, I have 25. We worked together for 3 years in the city in Sydney. He said, you know, you're great at running the business. I'll run the clients. I said, okay. So I helped him set up. This is March 2006. And Scott Elwin and Co. And off we went. It was going really well. My boss came back. He said, look, I promised this and now I'm offering that. I'm sorry, I didn't really do the numbers. I know it's different, but there you go. You've got a young kid. You need the cash flow. Tom, my son, was 9 months old. So you should just don't do anything silly and accept my offer. I went home. I told my wife, I said, listen, this is the third firm in a row. These partners are disorganized and dishonest, and I can't stand dishonest people. Can't trust them. Can't work with people like this. I'm just going to get out of the industry. I'm so sick of it. And my wife, Beck, who is the co-founder of the firm, again, quietly, just so supportive. My dad was hugely supportive of me, and he died a few months before. Beck just said, Brett, you're great at what you do. People love being your client. People love working with you. Beck, I met working with me in a firm. She's like, you're really, really great with people and you're a great leader. Just start a firm like you did with Scott. And I was very reluctant. I said, Beck, I'm sick of this shit. I can't stand it. They're miserable bastards. I'm sick of it. She said, yeah, but you're not like that, so just change it. And Beck is an Aries, wakes up happy every day, so positive. So I'm thinking, okay, honey, if you're pumped about it, righto. And then a number of my best mates who I own my clients under my contract, I'd said when I joined, if I'll own my clients, if you make me a partner, I'll swap them in for equity. And people always wanted to hire me because I was very, very good at getting clients. And I just said, to my clients, they were like, Brett, I can't believe you don't have your own firm. And I'm like, really? I'm trying to do a great thing for my boss. And they're like, mate, you should build a business. You're great at this. And I was like, righto. And then, you know, to be clear, I'd launched two books by this stage. My first book I launched at the National Press Club in Canberra with Senator Natasha Stott-Despoja, who wrote the foreword speaking about the book. This is the premier political forum in Australia and is the equivalent of the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. I launched my second book at the National Press Club with Malcolm Turnbull, who went on to become the Australian Prime Minister, at that time was a backbencher in the Parliament. Malcolm spoke about my book. You can look it up on YouTube. They're quite extraordinary things for a young person. When I look back now, I was 22 and 29, right? I'm 48 today. So I'd done some stuff, right? I'd met some people. I had the confidence of former prime ministers saying to me, Brett, you know, you're really great at this. You know, Bob Hawke said to me, just do this book, Brett. This will change your life. And I was like, mate, my mum thinks I should get a job. He's like, well, look, your mum's probably great, but I'll help you get anyone you need. Imelda Roach, who I interviewed, who sold, she was the first Australian to buy out the parent company of a US company, right? And then Nutramedics, and then she sold that for $250 million to which is billions in today's dollars, to Sara Lee Corporation. She was the wisest person I met. She was like, Brett, like, you're an amazing young guy. Anyone you want to meet, I'll introduce you to. She met me. She helped me get some of the interviews. So I had these people who had told me I was, you know, I was okay, and I was in a bad place, and it means an enormous amount to me today. And I try, if a young person comes past me and says, "Hey, Brett," I try to help those people and just say, you know, you're a good guy. And you'll be okay. So that's what happened. You know, I just started the firm. I thought, from a top of my hard place, I just said, look, I've got a 9-month-old. I've got $20,000. I have a $200,000 fee base. I put the 20 grand into my apartment in Kirribilli. I had a $200,000 mortgage. And it was, you know, it was month to month. And I thought, right, if we're going to do this, I'll sell my apartment in Kirribilli. I'll put all of the money. Luckily, I bought it for like 200 and something and sold it for nearly twice as much. I put all the profit into all my capital into the business, because my heroes had told me to do that. And I believed I could build a long-term Berkshire-style vehicle that I could compound my capital. And I thought, fuck it, I'll do my own deals. I'll prove that my crazy ideas aren't that crazy, that based on common decency, you could just do what you said you would do, and that would work well. And you'd be transparent, and you'd be aggressively transparent, because I am like that, born in the middle of eight boys. And I said, I'll do it. I sold my place, put the money into the company. I moved to Lane Cove first, which is sort of inner north, $500 a week rent. Then I moved to outer Western Sydney, $300 a week rent, in a $300,000 duplex. My wife had a young child. We had another child. You couldn't walk the streets as a young woman with young kids in that area. It's like pretty, you know, it's the second worst. We then moved to Oxley Park, which is next to Mount Druitt. It's the worst, second worst suburb in Sydney. It's the master key to building a business, sacrifice of something else. You know, you can't buy a house that you don't need to impress other people and build a business. I took 100% of my money, and money I just didn't have. I was offered three partner roles in firms at 350 grand a year. Most people would have taken that. Most wives would have told you to take that. Beck's like, nah, I believe in what we're doing. I would give Beck $100 a week. Say, please don't ask me for any more money. I do not have any more money. We had one car, a $6,000 Magna. I'd take the car every day. I'd leave at 3:30 in the morning. I'd get home at 8 o'clock at night, normally 7, have dinner, and then I'd work 8 till 11 in the garage. I would basically sleep 4 hours a night, get up at 3, give her Tom to feed, and have a shower and go to work. I did that for 5 years. I never took a day off other than Sundays. I never took a public holiday. I wrote all the systems. I built the critical activity network based on Porter stuff. What is competitive advantage? How do you build a unique set of activities based around key positions you want to own in the customer's mind? And then you systemize and duplicate. Front-end Maccas, back-end Walmart. Must be able to be duplicated in all times and places across all cultures under any professional services firm, but stay in your circle of competence accounting. There's a ton of depth. I could talk to you for 10 hours. I don't want to bore your listeners. And it isn't about me. I gathered these incredible people, Scott Elwin, Ada Poon, my mate Craig Bullock, Joyce Owl, within 12 months, my former boss from Pricewaterhouse, who employed me at 18, Stephen, was 26 years a partner, 9 years their CFO. He was 56 at the time he joined me. What am I going to do, Brett? I don't know. I'll give you a desk. You're a smart guy. You'll work it out. You've run 300 partners and X billion dollars, about $1 billion of revenue, and run the debt facilities on that, blah, blah, blah. So I sought wisdom, got older guys around me, bought my old bloke's firm, my old boss's firm after 12 months, Rex Hoban, a wonderful guy. He'd been my boss, and I went to him. His partners weren't treating him the right way. I saw that, young partners treating old partners badly. I thought, I'll just get all the old guys to join me. So I went around buying the firms off the old guys who I respect, have great values, kind of
old-fashioned values. In the book, The Outsiders, an often missed point, and I don't think William Thorndike emphasizes enough, is all of those guys have what he calls pre-modern values. They're old-fashioned values. You know, your word's your bond. If you say you're going to do it, you do it. You ring it back when you say, and you over-deliver, you over-service, and you're diligent and careful with your reputation. This sort of old-fashioned bizzo, with a modern take on how to do service and how to be inclusive and how to make sure there's an egalitarian bottom-up leadership style, that there's a real embrace of technology and systems and processes and what can make a difference. So take the old, take the new, get the yin, get the yang, you know, blend the old guys like your Buffetts with your Steve Jobses, and anyone that's got a good idea, the best idea wins. So it's an intellectual pursuit. I say do Walmart, go and buy firms where no one else wants to buy them, and get big before anyone realizes. Put them all on a common platform of mission, values, vision, same strategy, the same 51-49 after the 75-25 with Scott. I said, mate, it's not going to work. I voluntarily said, look, it should be 51-49, made him 49. Said, look, this is how the P&L works, otherwise the economics don't work. If I can double your profit and you still own 49%, you've got 100% of what you otherwise would have made, but I run the cash flow better, so you actually get more cash each month. So this will work, and I can scale it with one brand. So we changed Scott Irwin and Co. to Kelly Partners. Kelly Bullock, we changed to Kelly Partners, one brand, with this mindset of building essentially Macca's stores everywhere, that there's a profit pool of upper middle class driven private business owners in these places around Sydney. Now, I believe that then I saw Foxton's in London some years later. I believe 5, 6, 7 years later, I believe they were doing that, 36 offices in London at the time in real estate. I was like, yeah, we're on the right track. We can do this in any city in the world where we can find people that share these values. So if you don't share the values, waste of time. We'll do it. You know, I often get asked, would you do it anywhere or where would you do it? Go deep first. So own Sydney, don't own Australia. The industry is national. I wanted to own Sydney for private business owners. We've got, I think, the largest private business owner specialist firm in Sydney. We're well on our way in Victoria. We'll get there in Queensland, and we'll pursue that in any city in the world where we think it's in, you know, the business's interest in serving the clients. So that's the journey. There's a lot of emotion in that. You know, without Beck just being prepared to just cop $100 a week and never complain, never ask for more money, never buy a dress without ringing me and saying, hey, Brett, like, can we afford it? And I'm like, well, you can see the bank account. We should get the bag and the shoes, but maybe we wait 2 weeks or 4 weeks, because I'm a naturally sort of generous person, but just wanted to be fiscally prudent. And to me, I'm more like Munger in that respect than Warren, who's colorblind and doesn't like art or doesn't understand it or doesn't see it, because I think he is colorblind. So, mate, that's the journey. There's a deep well of reason for doing what we do. There's a lot of emotion invested in the business. And, you know, I once heard a great speaker say that motion comes from, you know, that motion is the big word in emotion. Without a lot of emotion, there ain't going to be much motion. And so, you know, I was with a fighter pilot the other day actually asking him, you know, how did he get trained and, you know, what? How does it all work? And he said, Brett, you know, at bottom end, it's all about commitment. And so you can't put, you know, early on I knew you can't make someone self-motivated. You can't make somebody self-disciplined. Then you can't put mongrel and meaning and drive and into someone's heart and soul. So you've got to find the people that have it. And I think we're like, I always feel like we're the only ones looking for those people. So there's no competition, because those people find each other. And if you don't at the leadership level have that passion and that real depth of meaning and that drive that comes from it, you can't fake it. You just can't fake it. And it resonates on a sort of vibe level with people, just on a wavelength level. They just feel the drive, and they are either repulsed by it because they just think you're 24 hours a day and you're just annoying and you're too energetic and you're just a pain in the ass, or they're very attracted to it. And I'm, you know, understand that some people would find me really annoying. I understand that.
Yeah, huge thanks for sharing that, Brett. I think a lot of people see the success of a business like KPG today, but they don't take the time, or they don't understand kind of the struggles that go into it, particularly early on.
People don't realize that building a great big building, you go down 40 levels if you want to go up 40 levels. You dig a big hole. And when you dig in that big hole, You're doing it by yourself. You got no friends. You're in the dark. Often you're getting mocked and scorned and bagged. You're driving a shit car or no car. You don't have anything funky or fancy. And there you have no friends when you're digging that big hole. And everyone thinks you're digging yourself into a hole, whereas I was digging purposely and purposefully a hole that was to build a foundation, to put down the steel, to pour the concrete. Now, when you're down subterraneally in the muck, in the shit, and it stinks down there just quietly, and it's under your nails and under your fingernails, and you carry it sort of everywhere you go, and no one really wants to hang out with you. Basically, you've got no friends, and then you're putting in the levels. And as you put the levels in, eventually you break through ground level. Once you get to ground level, you just start slapping up levels and it looks really easy. And then you've got all these Johnny-come-lately friends who want to be part of what you're doing. They don't really share those values. And that's where the values are really important, and your ability to sift those people are really important. Who's here for the journey? Who wants to dig the big dark hole? Who would be with you in the dark hole? And who's just here because they want the view from the penthouse? And so if you can keep attracting those people, you can keep just compounding, flywheeling, slapping up floor after floor, and you know what you're doing and it's easy to do. But it's very easy for people to look at you and think, oh, that's easy. What that guy's doing, that's real easy. We got manuals and hundreds of thousands of hours of deep thinking and experience. We've done 63 transactions. We've rejected 1,000 firms. I've done thousands of meetings with people and heard all sorts of BS. So you've got a good BS detector, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I missed the birth of my third child. I spoke at the conference of our largest client. That's how I am. I was there. Beck was in hospital for nearly 9 weeks pre the birth, 6 weeks pre the birth, 3 weeks after. She was very sick. I went every day in the morning, every day at night. I took her 8 bottles of water. Her waters had broken. Audrey's life was at risk. But I said, honey, like after 6 weeks, I said, I've told this firm that I would speak at their conference. I'm opening their conference. I can't not go. I've said I will do it. I can't. It's in my DNA. So I flew to Melbourne. I went down to near Torquay at 5 o'clock in the morning. I get this text message. I've been rushed into the hospital. Sorry, into theatre. They're going to do an emergency seizure. You're not here. I've got to get my mum. And thankfully Beck was okay. I got up. I did my keynote. I did the talk at 9 o'clock. I finished at 9:45. I drove back to Melbourne. I got on the first plane. I was back in outer Western Sydney at the hospital, in the Penrith Hospital near Penrith, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But forever, Beck will say, you know, you weren't at Audrey's birth. That's what's gone into this business. Most people wouldn't give up a coffee. They certainly wouldn't sell their house in a salubrious suburb to move to a suburb that didn't resonate positively with their friends, who they aren't really friends with anyway. So there's a lot of sacrifice behind building anything. And I could tell you 100 of those stories. And so there is an edge to me when people come near our business, they make, you know, flippant or derogatory comments or comments that show their shallowness. And we're trying to be deep people in a shallow world. I don't have a lot of emotional reserves for that sort of bullshit. My daughter was born with serious complications. She had serious kidney surgery. She was born very early, 30-odd weeks, 29 weeks. She had, in the first year of her life, she had major kidney surgery. We visited the hospital emergency over 100 times in the next 5 years. She had serious heart conditions. She had 2 major open heart surgeries. She had a major open heart surgery 10 days before I listed the company. I told the investors in the pre-IPO that I had a sick daughter. I would do no acquisitions in the first 12 months. None of them believed me. And then I did no acquisitions in the first 12 months. People are like, why have you done any acquisitions? I said, well, I have a sick daughter. I told you, we're building a 100-year business. I'm not going to do any acquisitions in the first 12 months unless they literally walk in the door, because I don't have the bandwidth. But it's amazing people don't listen. I had my major shareholder, after they sold down, say to me, Brett, I can't believe you still own basically all of your stock. We thought you'd just sell out or sell down. I said, well, I said I wouldn't, but you don't listen. And just because you're in the spin the money game, I'm in the build an amazing business game. So when you're around people that don't keep their word, it's difficult for them to imagine that you will. I've always said that I'll maintain a controlling interest in the firm. In Australia, that needs to be more than 50%. I ultimately aspire to get a structure that allows me to have a buffered structure, a dual class structure, so that I can keep control of the firm and make sure that I can be funded externally to the business so that I can stop paying dividends and ultimately compound like Berkshire. So, mate, there's a lot to the business. And you bring that to, you know, I think your listeners, and you can probably get a sense, Tom, if you come near that, there's some power in that. There's some power in these big ideas and that level of that commitment. And it's actually that that makes things happen. It's not whether we finance like this or our margins are like this or our blah, blah, blah. They're outcomes, mate, and we've got a strong financial model and a better understanding of these firms, I believe, than anyone that operates, you know, in this very small circle of competence anywhere in the world, by my estimation. And I have met many, many of those people now. They come to us and ask questions, and we've built some great relationships. So, mate, that's where we are. That's kind of the story.
Love it. And I remember you telling us about the depths of the foundations and the Berkshire line. Actually, I'm not sure if you recall that, but there were a few more four-letter words when you were describing it, as I recall.
Basically, the four-letter word I try not to use is busy, which I really quite offend. Every other four-letter word I'm okay with, but, I'm very direct by nature. I played a lot of serious sport, and, I will swear about ideas, but I don't swear about people.
Yep, love it. Look, I'm keen to kind of
shit ideas, Tom. Like in our industry, I was a young guy putting up with the fact that our industry floats on what I call shit. Myths, bullshit, you know, wives' tales and legends. None of it tested by data. None of it tested against whether it makes people better off, whether it makes clients better off, whether it makes communities better off. And so it's a frustrating business to be involved, industry to be involved in, because the industry generally is very poor versus, your Apples, your world-class Louis Vuitton, Moët Hennessy, Berkshire's, your very world-class businesses. So you will hear the S word quite often from me, and I'll try in this discussion to keep it clean.
No, you're welcome to communicate these ideas however you prefer, Brett. A couple questions on kind of KPG today. Can you talk me through a couple of things around Cali Partners? What was the decision like to go public and list on the ASX? I guess what were some of the drivers behind that? And can you talk me through your partner owner driver model, how the kind of 51-49 split works, and what the
why IPO? All right,
sure.
Our industry lives in the shadows. Often the big four and other businesses have involved themselves in behavior that wouldn't stand up to the light of day. And what I mean by that is involving themselves in work that doesn't resonate with the values of people under 40. There's been a lot of leaking of tax papers, Panama papers, and all sorts of things that indicate that a lot of firms have involved themselves in behavior that just doesn't resonate with the common decency of people. We are trying to position the firm to be a brand that resonates with people under 100 that have great values. And I just have a personal view, having experienced that many participants at the large end of our industry globally don't have those values. And if they do, they haven't lived them out. If you read the book, The Big Four, they started with those values. And I'm not picking on the Big Four, basically the Big 25 around the world, the Big 20, second tier. They've, KPMG have just been banned from doing something somewhere. KPMG here in Australia they had grads cheating on their CA program, and they've been in trouble for that. It's just been a lot of systemic bad behavior. Who audited Enron, et cetera. So we just are trying to deliberately not be that. We believe that presents a massive values-led opportunity in our industry. It's a bit zen, hard to understand. We wanted to go public because we believe that the way we run the business, we can do in public. And I believe that our competitors can't be public companies because the way they behave, they couldn't do in public. Now, I needed the credibility of the public markets so that older owners of these firms have poured their hearts and souls into and minds into, so that those people would feel like they could join us because we're a credible organization. As a young guy, I'm 30, I'm trying to buy these firms. These older blokes would say to me, well, what are you going to pay for it with? And I'd be like, well, we're actually pretty profitable and we've got the money. And they just wouldn't believe me. I remember a guy going through our bank statements, auditing us, and going, well, it all looks good, but I just can't believe it. I said, well, what bit can't you believe? He goes, well, my lockup's 150 days and yours is like 20. So that just doesn't seem right. And I'm like, okay, well, it's different, but it is right. So that's why we wanted to be able to attract great firms, great people. And essentially we believe, Tom, that when I was thinking about going public, all the private equity firms would say, look, your business isn't worth very much because, you know, it's not public and it's not really real. So we want to give you a bad valuation and we'll give you some money and teach you how to do some stuff and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, okay, well, I reckon it is real. So why don't we just go public and then we'll show that it is real. And again, my big hero, I'll try not to mention him by name, says judge us in 5-year periods. So I said, right, I set myself to say, let's get a 5-year plan and we'll just quietly work on proving to the market over 5 years that our model is unique to us, which we have trademarked the partner owner driver model. It's a 51-49, not a 10-year commitment from partners up front model with many very unique elements. And we'll just prove it publicly, which we're well on our way to doing. So we were right about that in that, you know, investors have seen that, hang on, this works. There's genuine deep alignment around mission, values, vision. There's a clear strategy and a structure in the partner owner driver model that captures that strategy so it can be operationalized. And then there's a documented way of running these businesses that accountants frankly like. We have this thing called a central progress team where we centralize everything that an accountant doesn't want to do. So what they do is they inspire their people, develop their people and behave in an attractive way for the talent market and look after their clients with our unique client system in a really great way. That's their role, be community ambassadors. They have three things to do. That's all they have to do. They don't have to run their IT. They don't have to run their marketing. They don't have to go and find candidates. We do their recruitment and send them great people to interview. So basically I saw, having been an accountant from undergrad to, you know, associate director in these firms, I know these firms inside out, backwards, and that makes a difference. Anyone that's ever tried to do what we're doing has been a financial person with a spreadsheet or a financial planner trying to rig up something to sell their stock to, you know, for more than they paid for it. They've been what I call promoters, not what we call founders. If you read a book by Bain and Co. called The Founder's Mentality and really study it and then have a look at someone like me, you'll see some real resonance because I read that book and I was like, oh, that's how I am. Right, I get it. I'm not like that. That's what is the difference, that those values. And then I've attracted people into these 51-49 situations who are founders by mentality. They come, they found firms. If they're in a firm, we step them up and we turn them into founder mentality owners. And we behave like that and we drive that accountability and we drive that behavior. And if you're not like that, you hate us and you'll never join us. And you'll run around telling everyone that we're weird and different and whatever, which is okay because we are. That's kind of indifferentiation. There's a big word. Everyone accepts that differentiation is important in a business. Well, the big word in the middle of differentiation is different. But many people are uncomfortable with different. So get comfortable with different if you want to have differentiation. And so you're going to be hanging around the weird people who are the founders that are different. Everyone I've met that's built a big business, they're different. And all the ones I admire, like Scoot Turner, who built Flight Center, he's different. You read his book, he's different. Watch his videos, he's not like everyone else. And that's okay. Like, you don't want Danny him in your business. But, you know, without him, I don't think Flight Center would be Flight Center, right? And doesn't mean Flight Center doesn't operate without him. But someone's got to light the fire of you know, of the mission and the values and the vision and kind of keep the flame, I think. I don't know. Maybe other people know better, but I don't think Berkshire would be Berkshire without Warren. And I don't think Apple would be Apple without Steve. But, hey, Tim Cook's doing an even better job. I got to meet Tim at the meeting, which is extraordinary, get a photo with him before 10,000 people try to crush us, which is really cool. And, again, very gracious, lovely guy and quiet as to who we are and what we're doing. And my CFO got a photo with him, which was extraordinary. You know, he's doing a great job of that business. So it's not, if you build a great business, you find a like-minded person, I'm sure they can help you grow it, you know. So that's the partner, owner, driver. What's it all about? Well, we run partnerships genuinely. We want owners. And we want owners because we know they're driven. We want to help them drive those businesses. It's a bottom-up model. It's not a top-down corporate. You change the world and you lead businesses Gandhi style. You don't go to, you know, the big guy from England that's running your country. You get a million or so or more people to do the salt march with you. That's what you do. You lead from the bottom up with this mission. with these big ideas and you say, hey, you want to be part of this? And then the driven ones, they want to be owners. They want to stake in that. They want to share. No worries. I want you to as well. How about we have a partnership? Now I bring me and our team. That's quite valuable. Methodology, insight, wisdom. It's acknowledged that we know how to double the profitability of a firm, how to reduce the working capital it uses by 2/3. We have a turnover of people in our business. It's about 1/3 of the industry. We know how to, we believe, inspire and encourage and develop people to be the best they can be. It's not because we're rocket science, Tom. It's just that we really think about it. And then we believe in this idea of sort of overwhelming action, like extreme execution, which is really what I'm best at, in that, you know, if you give me a big idea that makes sense, it's going in the manual and we're going to start doing it every day. Like we read Cunningham's book on quality shareholders. The next day we did it. We fixed the website. We sorted out our owner's manual, made it clearer. We published a quality shareholders newsletter. And these were all things that professional IR for the first 3 years of the company told me I wasn't allowed to do, right? So I just went, no, it's our company. We have to communicate in a way that reflects who we are. And we'll find the people that that resonates with, and we'll confidently build the business and the quality shareholder base, people that want to be our partners forever, because we believe partnership's about forever. Now, in this partner-owner-driver model, if you want to become a partner at Kelly Partners, you have to sign a 10-year agreement. It's marriage, not dating. The reason we do it is we're trying to get the short-term, shallow people not to join us. We're not actually trying to tie you into anything. We're just trying to say, mate, if you're a long-term guy, come with us. If you're a short-term guy, go with the industry. No one has the gumption to try and mimic that, right? Sign here, 10 years. And by the way, if you leave in that period, it's very punitive. So, which we're not going to share the details with people, but it's extremely punitive. So if you don't want to sign up for 10 years, you better not join us. Because we really don't want the wrong people to join, because it wastes time. It damages the culture. Bad eggs stink and they do bad things. So we have run the business by trying to get the wrong people not to join us. That's how we find the right people. This is Munger. Flip it. Invert. Right? And we're trying to get the wrong employees not to join us. We're trying to get the wrong, you know, clients not to join us. I started the firm, you had to pay 50% up front. I'll give you a fixed fee, but you have to put money in my bank account before I start, because I knew I couldn't afford to go broke. I had an obligation to pay our people. The people went, well, that won't work. That's ridiculous. Well, here's the big news. It worked. The 200,000 of clients I had, they all agreed. They all signed. In fact, my first client, the first money that hit the bank, was a client that turned around with me and said, Brett, in business only the paranoid survive. You're paranoid, you'll survive. And I don't want to write two checks, so I'll write you a check for 100% of my annual fee, which is $28,000, and that will help your cash flow. An extraordinary gesture, right? But that's what you attract when you stand for something. And so off we went with all these ideas that, in my view, drive deep alignment. We won't involve ourselves in a community organization where the partners won't sit on the board, won't communicate, won't contribute their time. If you're not committed enough to go to the board meetings, put your time in, we're not putting our money in. So, mate, that's the drive around values. That's where the partner-owner-driver model comes from. Other people say to me, oh, well, other people could copy that. Good luck. You'd have to have the gumption to drive that over and over. You'd have to give up revenue. You'd have to give up the lateral hire partners who say, oh, I can promise the world, but I'm not signing that. My long term's 5 years. Well, that's fine. Let me call your wife and tell her that, right? I'm her husband. We just believe in these ideas and they work, because as a young guy, I wanted to work with a boss that was interested in working with me for a long time. I wanted a boss that was committed to my development, that actually cared about me enough to make a commitment my way, such that I'd make a commitment their way. I believed as an employee, I was more committed to making the firms I worked in better than the bosses I worked with. So I say to our partners and I say to our clients, it's not the employees, it's normally the boss. 99% of employees I've ever worked with or had work with us are more committed to their careers than the boss is committed to the business. That's terrible, right? The boss is out to lunch. He's out to his yacht. He's out to golf. He's not improving the systems. He's not improving the business. He's not staying current. He's not reading. He's not meeting people. He's not educating. So when we look at our client system, for example, Tom, I ask my clients to plan 12 months ahead their learning as well as their holidays. Their holidays so that they can stay fit and fresh. But I ask them to plan their learning because I say the fish rots from the head down. If you're not learning, you're not growing, your business can't grow. And then your people have to put up with your recalcitrant backward ways because you're too stupid to know what's going on. Talk to your children. Find out the technology. Recently, I interviewed Shaquille O'Neal for our podcast. How did I get that idea? My kids are 17, they're 15, 10. They're really committed. They've got smart friends. And they're like, Dad, Shaq's coming to Australia. Did you know he'd done this? No. I start researching him. The guy's an extraordinary business person, I think an extraordinary leader, humble about the mistakes that he's made in his life and inspiring to other people. I pursued him over 9 days or 2 weeks. We had 9 days' notice that he'd do it. Who did I put in the room? Potential future employees, current employees, existing clients, future clients. I signed up all the future employees. I signed up all the future clients. I put the kids of our clients in there and inspired the kids. He loved it. He said it was the best thing he did in Australia. I put it on YouTube. We got over 300,000 views. We got 10 million views on an ESPN clip that we shared. ESPN wanted to share it. They shared it. We're building the brand on a global basis, and frankly, it was quite cheap. So we'll do offbeat things, but they're all aligned to these values. What would happen if you really genuinely believe that your role was to make people better off, which means healthier, wealthier, and wiser? And you just use the vehicle of your profession to do that. And tax, no one likes paying tax, my friend. So they're always up for a chat about how to minimize that. And while they're having that chat, we try to make their life better, which means get them personally, business, wealth, estate, learning, and holidays organized so that they can be the best person they can be, so they can be the best business owner they can be. And that's a winning formula. We're confident of that at this point. The business is nearly 17 years old. It's compounded a cumulative average growth rate of over 30%. It's doubled 5 times in a row. This is not a new thing. And so that's the model. That's where it comes from. And if anyone thinks they can duplicate that, that's cool. Like I encourage, what's that? Mimicry is the best form of flattery. I don't care. I care about doing the best that we can do every day.
Very cool. I was going to ask you about the Shaq podcast as well. I believe he's a shareholder now. Is that correct?
Well, we gave him $1,000 worth of shares. Yeah. And then he asked me, could he get, I think, 1 million or 5 million if he landed that hoop. It was the only shot he took on the entire Australian tour. I said I'd back that with my own shares, mind you, and I was prepared to. Thankfully, he missed. But, I must look up whether he's claimed his shares. Might be a bit small fry for him. But, he identified the mission that we're trying to solve.
Yeah, love it. Couple of kind of questions on the structure of KPG. Can you just run me through, with the partner owner driver model, what do people actually, what do they buy and what do they own when they buy KPG shares on the ASX? And can you also just speak to how the debt is structured in KPG? I think that's something that often confuses people or catches them out.
Yeah, it's funny. So let's think about the industry. In the industry, you have a firm. Let's say we do $2 million, you and I, Tom, and you own 50% and I own 50%. The result of that is that we're both in charge. We don't recognize our differences. We can't really have an effective splitting of responsibilities. And basically, you're part-time IT and HR, I'm part-time marketing and people. Nothing ever gets done. You do a shoddy job of everything, the clients including the firm. I have to work there as a young guy and think, what's wrong with these old fellas? Why don't they run this like a business? But basically, it's a partnership structure, and the structure means that 100% of the profit gets ripped out of the business. In fact, people live beyond their means. So when you make a dollar, you take 52 cents each, and the business is always underinvested in. In a corporate structure, you'd be able to retain profits, and theoretically, that would mean you'd invest in the business. I turned up and said, you need a 51-49 so someone's in charge, because when someone's in charge, leadership can happen. What's leadership? Decisions get made. They get made fast. It's not a lot. It's not brain surgery. It's not like we're cutting the wrong part of the brain. We've got to make a decision. It's normally this or that, and we need to make them fast so that we can drive the businesses and inspire our people. In our system, you're, as a 49% partner, Tom, you're going to make decisions, because I'm going to come into the meeting and say, what are we doing, Tom? This or that? I'm going to the bathroom. When I get back, make a choice. I've never had to have a vote.
where I've had to vote my 51% on any partnership matter in nearly 17 years across more than 25, what's now 30 partnerships. So leadership matters, and that's the primary thing wrong with most firms, that they're not well led. When private equity guys said to me, why are your margins like they are? We've got better leadership through a better structure, amongst many other things. Then what do we do? We say, you're going to pay 6.5% of your revenue for our services, which is going to be everything running the firm except you running the people and the clients. You're doing some receding and things locally, but basically we run the firm as essentially a managed service. You run the clients and the people and the clients in that order. And you pay 2.5% for IP. That means before the EBITDA line, we spend 9% of revenues making the firms better. And this is the thing that people miss most about this business of ours. So by the time we're splitting the EBITDA, you and I, we've already invested 9% in making the business better. None of our competitors are investing 1 cent in making the business better. They invest as little as possible so the partnership can make 100 cents, and then you and I take 52 cents each. That's the game. We invest this 9%. I believe that would compound the flywheel over time. Jim Collins talks about one side of the flywheel mission, one side of the flywheel fuel. You need fuel, that's the 9%. You need a mission, change the world through changing the business owners to help people be better off, to help them employ more people. Clear mission, clear fuel, and it's working. 9% of 80 million plus this year will be a big number, 7.2 million. There is no $5 million revenue accounting firm anywhere in the world that's spending $7.2 million a year making their firm better. When we buy into the firm next to you, you're doing $5 million, our firm's doing $5 million, but we put $7.2 million a year worth of resource under that firm. Good luck. You have no chance. You have no chance in the short term, and in the long term, we're going to grind you every single day. And what that means is we're going to out-employ you. Why would I work for you under-invested bunch of schmucks who are taking 52% each, right, when they can work in a modern-driven organization that's reinvesting in their employment proposition first, in their client proposition next, in their community proposition, and flywheeling that to make people better off? That's unbelievably powerful. And we think quite unduplicatable, because to get partners to agree to that is impossible. You've got to prove that you can drive profit, which basically no one globally has been able to do, and so good luck. In the US, 18% EBITDA pre-partner rem. If you pay them 10 or 12%, basically you're making 8%. If you pay 9%, you're making minus 1%. It's going to be difficult to solve for most people. We think we've got a 20-year jump on the world. We're going to keep doing it because we've got proven track record and consensus around that. So that's what that model is. Now, what does KPG own? KPG owns the 51 and our local partners own the 49. It's through a sub under KPG. Then there's a special purpose vehicle. That's where the debt lives. The debt lives on the assets, on those local assets. There's no cross-collateralization side to side so that one can't infect the other. And so, what's funny is people poke around, Tom, and they miss like the forest for the trees type of thing. They go, what about the debt? Well, our per partner debt is no different to the per partner debt. In fact, it's lower than what you'd be asked to contribute to a firm our size. If you go and become a partner in a firm doing 80 plus million of revenue, they're going to say, congratulations, Tom, sign here, and you've got to sign up to personally guarantee and contribute $400,000 plus of working capital. And they're going to basically stick that into working capital. You're never going to see it again, right? Our guys borrow on their equity. It's a goodwill partnership, and they pay off the equity. Once they own that equity, it has a value under the partnership agreement. The value is higher than the market value that they would otherwise get if they went down the road and sold it. It's deeply, deeply, deeply thought out. We're not sharing too much more about it because we really don't want to teach anyone else how to do it or really tell anyone much. But you can trust us that it works and you can see the numbers. That's kind of the game. All I did was take my equity stake public. I own 51% of all these firms and I went public because I believed that we could build a Berkshire-style holdco that would be the permanent owner of firms that these largely men over 65 had spent their whole lives building, that spent more time with this baby than they had with their actual baby, and they care deeply about who might be the owner. I looked at Warren and said, I want to be the Warren Buffett of accounting. I want to be the first choice owner for the best firms, and those best firms are defined by those that share our values, that have a founders, have partners that have spilled blood to build that business and really care about their people and clients and the community that they're operating in. Now, if they're just looking for a bigger check, we don't pay more than anyone else. They're just looking for money, we're not into the love for money business, right? We're into the love for love business. So that's quite a distinction your listeners can reflect on. And so, you know, we're trying to find people that really want the best for others. That's true love, and want the best for our group and choose to join our group. So that's how it works. The debt is moderate. We pay it off. Our bit, we're just paying off rapidly. You can see the principal that we pay off. I think we've got over $8 million in principal we pay off a year. And we do pay dividends. You know, theoretically, we could just pay all the debt off. But then at the moment, people say, well, do you pay dividends? Good question. You know, the debt is readily available, very competitively priced, makes sense from an asset allocation position, creates alignment, just makes sense. So, mate, that's the model. Hopefully your listeners can get a sense. I've probably thought about it a little bit. And, you know, it's not a roll-up. And so if you use the word roll-up near me, you'll get a very aggressive response typically, because it indicates that, A, you're not an accountant and don't understand the difference between, you know, a head co buying 100% and haven't actually made the effort to what I think we've extensively explained in the market, and the differences around, you know, who runs a spin up. I call them a spin up and flog off, you know, a sort of musical chair business, and who does what we're doing, which is harder. You know, if we listed 100% of our revenues, we'd be a much larger looking thing, at least for a moment, but it wouldn't have the same commitment and alignment through the business. So it wouldn't work.
Gotcha. No, that's really helpful, Brett. I know you've got to run shortly, but I've got one more. It's a fairly meaty topic here to cover, but I'm keen for you to share some general thoughts at least. So I know you're reasonably heavily influenced, as far as I can gather, by the book The Outsiders in terms of how you think about capital allocation. And
yeah, I love that. Also, I think it's a work of genius.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know what took me so long, but I eventually got around to that one earlier in the year. And it's a good one. I guess the other thing I was going to say is I've also heard you mention that if you could ask Buffett one question, it was about whether KPG could pay a dividend. So just interested to hear.
Yeah, I'll change that one. My answer, I get asked, you know, would you like to meet Buffett? No, I don't think that's fair. He's a very old gentleman, and right. You know, I don't know how much time he's got left. I wouldn't ask him after he's taught me so much to waste time speaking to me. If he insisted, I'd just ask him to read our accounts and make comments as to how we could make them, you know, even better from the WEB perspective, which would be incredible, right? So that's kind of a question I get asked a lot. So Outsiders is incredible. You know, what are we ultimately want to be? We want to be a global business that can solve this problem in 5 English speaking markets: Australia, New Zealand, the US, Canada, and the UK. We're working on that very diligently, and we think that using the Collins sort of first bullets, then cannonballs, we can buy a small firm in the UK and the US, perfect our model on a very small firm, and then build a team to scale that. We will self-fund that. We will not need to raise material capital to do that, although we're open to doing that, to raising some capital. And we believe that what we're trying to do around brand, digital, and people is best solved on a global basis. And we think, I always, you know, we made our Kelly Partners blue. That's the blue of Sydney Harbour. I wanted to win in Sydney because Bulgari is Roma, Tiffany is New York, Burberry is London, and I wanted Kelly Partners to be Sydney. And I wanted to take that irreverent, driven, Sydney have a go attitude to the world as a global brand. So that's, you know, that's the big picture, you know, BHAG, if you like, for the business. And I believe I can take that blue and that Australian drive and irreverence and entrepreneurship all around the world. I was in the US for 5 weeks recently. I was there for 4 weeks in April. And every time I saw the Westfield brand and the Westfield centers, and if you read Frank Lowy's book, The Founder of Westfield, and how they did the US, that has inspired us. And we could see them as an example of what's possible. And I'm sure if Frank had sat around telling everyone his big vision, they'd have all laughed at him, I'm sure. But there it is. So what is the game from an outsider's perspective? The best book I've probably read in a long time is the book on Warren Buffett's shareholder letters pre-Berkshire. And it shares, and I'm trying to, you know, somebody out there will know, but I believe Warren went back to Omaha with $160,000, spent $30,000 cash on a house and had $130,000. He thought he could do 10% a year and live on that, which if a house is 30 grand, 10% on 130 is 13, which is a third of a house. And he would just compound, you know, live on that and compound the rest forever. Then he started doing his partnerships. It became Berkshire. He's never taken a dollar, really, his 100 grand plus expenses out of Berkshire. He's been able to self-fund himself. If I'd known that pre-IPO, I might have tried to structure myself differently. I think I've done it the right way. I've tried to be transparent and do the best I could. But I don't have enough personal capital outside the business to live in the way that I think is appropriate for who I am as a person. It's just my own proclivities, if you like. I recently was in Pasadena and drove past Charlie Munger's house. I went to Omaha and drove past Warren's house, went outside, and they have quite different homes because they're different people. And so I think you have to recognize that in yourself. So ultimately, I want to get a dual class structure on an exchange that will permit that, do a primary and secondary issue to raise the capital that we need to grow globally, which is not very much, which is probably hardly any, frankly. But there's a lot of people that want to own our shares. And if I can make that opportunity available at an appropriate valuation, then I'll do that to increase the liquidity that people complain about. I always say to them, I think there's only 36 Rembrandts in the world. Would it be a good idea if he woke up and painted 36 more? So liquidity, what's the problem? Like,
yeah,
it's probably not a bad thing that we keep reducing the number of shares on issue rather than issuing more, but you know, that's another discussion. And then we'll be in a position to have, you know, I essentially long-term when I own 32.5% of a company where I have 65% of the votes. And where'd I get that idea? I got that from Warren. That's just Warren's idea. And, you know, have the capital to be able to stop paying dividends and permanently compound literally exactly the way Berkshire have done. Like, there's no new ideas there. I don't want anyone to suggest that I think I'm anything like, you know, my heroes, because I'm not so presumptuous as to imagine that. You know, frankly, I think Warren's net worth, if he hadn't have given $30 billion away, would probably be about $500 billion. So if you're 10% as good as Warren, you'd be worth $50 billion. And if you're 1% as good, you'd be worth $5 billion. And if you're 1% as good as that, you'd be worth $500 million. So, you know, hopefully it could be acceptable to people that if I aspire to be maybe 0.1 or 0.01% as good as Warren at compounding capital for a long period of time, then that would be acceptable to our quality shareholder partners and, you know, just the peanuts generally who make silly comments if we tell them we've read a cool book that we think can change their life. Now, on the matter of a cool book, The Outsiders has a checklist, and there's a great book called The Checklist, which was written by a surgeon who realized that people were dying in the hospital because people kept leaving instruments inside them. So I founded this business on all these checklists of systems and processes because we do a lot of work with McDonald's and we've always been inspired by how good they are at systems. And so I'm a checklist guy, for better or worse, sorry, people. And so I love The Outsiders checklist. I ticked it off. I saw a lot of ourselves in what we're doing. We keep it, you know, we mention it publicly so that you as a shareholder or whoever's a shareholder will hold us accountable. We'll say, well, Brett, if you're doing that, how does that relate to this? How do you reconcile those two things? And I keep that book right near me. And, you know, this is a very substantially read book. And so if I'm having a moment and I'm trying to work something out, I can just go to my book and look and think and sort of ruminate on what to do. You'll be interested, Tom. One of my favorite books is Toughen Up, Michael Hill's book. Michael's book I read in, I think it was 2009, and that's how I realized I needed to keep more than 50% of the book, more than 50% of the business when I listed on the ASX. And the reason is he told me to. It's in his book. So, you know, basically to improve our business from an outsider's perspective, we need to get a structure that allows me to keep control and stop paying dividends. So I've got to be able to fund my life and not pay dividends. And so I'm working on that. And ultimately our, you know, we'll put something out. If it hasn't gone out yet today, we'll put something out about our plan to grow globally. And we've got an ASX announcement on that. And you know, we're very seriously pursuing becoming what ultimately, you know, as a group we want to become, and we believe we've got the support of our shareholders to do that. The idea actually came from the dual class idea, came from investors out of Scandinavia, which were like, Brett, will you sell me some shares? I know you're not going to, you know, in Australia, you know, if you can't keep control. And they're actually, I think, out of Finland, and they didn't realize we can't have a dual class in Australia. And they were like, have you heard of Carl Bennett, the Swedish guy? And they knew him, and they introduced us to some great guys from Lifeco. And it's, you know, the best thing about being listed, Tom, is the people we meet, and they introduce us to these amazing companies around the world who teach us amazing things. So I talk to a guy who'd been at Lifeco for 25 years. He teaches us things. We meet you guys, meet all sorts of people. And basically it's free consulting on our business. They just keep telling us how to do things better. And then if you're humble and crazily determined, you just take their great ideas and thank them and then do them. And then interestingly, like Michael Hill, I wrote a letter to him last year in lockdown. I started writing letters to thank all the people that had helped me, even though they didn't realize. And I just wrote to him and said, like, I really appreciate the book you wrote. It really changed my life. This is what I did with it. And he wrote me the most beautiful email back. Said, you know, I'm 83. It's like a really special thing when somebody says thank you. Like, that guy's kind of, you know, done everything and owns the whole world type of thing. So, mate, that's the journey. We think, you know, I'm often asked, in the Australian context, dividends are great because they're tax paid and it's beautiful. I pay monthly dividends. As a group, we wanted to do that because I wanted to grind the idea that we've got great cash flow and we're really good at running the numbers and we can just pay you a monthly dividend. I've now got a groundswell of people who are saying, Brett, I think our ROE is over 40%. So they're kind of like, you know, ROIC is massive if you know how to measure it intelligently. So they're like, why couldn't we like leave more capital in the business and you could do more of that? I've never sold a significant by a dollar stake in the business. So, you know, I've got three kids and I've just funded us as we've gone. And so at some point I'll try and get myself even better set up, which I think will allow me to lead the business in a more expansive way ultimately, which will help us a lot. So final thing, I guess, for me is that, like, we see a huge opportunity in the US. California is where we're going to target. It's the fourth largest economy in the world. It's just like Sydney, frankly. We've spent a lot of time and money and effort to get to know the industry. There's 10 to 15 times the opportunity. The number 100 firm in Australia is 4.4 million. The number 100 firm in the US is 44 million. The market's literally 10 to 1. The dynamics are the same. The average age that we can work out of firms is like 68, the guys who are trying to get out. The firms that we, by our analysis, in fact, cheaper. We think we can even achieve a higher ROE there than we can here, which is a pretty interesting reason to do it. And there's a lot of demand, frankly. People have been asking me. I've done talks like this with many, many, many people from all over the world, from Paris, from Malta, from the US and Canada, UK. And they're like, why aren't you here? And I'm like, well, let's just, you know, one step at a time, make sure that we've got an ability to continually compound Australia in the way that we have, which is double it every 3.5 years forever. And can we build the muscle, which is really the team? Can we get the right people that share our mission, values, and vision that want to be part of what we're doing and want to help us grow so that ultimately we've got a seamless, you know, in a global world, a seamless service to these private business owners who increasingly operate globally. No one else has that vision. I don't think anyone else is crazy enough to try and get it done. There's lots of global accounting firms. They kind of rent their brand and have these weird structures that I don't think actually serves the people or the clients. When I was at Price Waterhouse, they attracted me by saying we're a global firm and you could work in London. And when I wanted to work in London, it was actually easier to resign from the firm, fly to London and apply than it was to get transferred. And that is still the case today because of the structure of those firms. Most of the second tier firms, pretty much them all, they rent their brands from each other and they kind of friendly but not really friends. They're certainly not family. And for a client, it's grindy. The clients are telling me this. There's a huge number of Australians in London, in Los Angeles. They're underserved or unserved. And, you know, if we can do as I tried in the beginning and, with what we're doing at KPG, I said, look, I didn't believe we could be better, but I knew that we couldn't be worse. And so that is a way to try and stay humble and stay keen and stay driven and continually
press yourself, you know, to be the best you can. You know, you asked me about Shaq, Tom, and I did want to share with your audience that, you know, I am pursuing a vision with my podcast now, which is called Be Better Off Show, to rather than just have really good guests, to do what I did with my first book, Collective Wisdom, which people can look up. I had 34 of the most outstanding people in Australia. I believe now that I can attract 34 of the world's most outstanding people to our podcast. And so that's why I did Shaq. I'm now after the world's most extraordinary people across business, sport, politics, the arts, or any endeavor, community, B Corps, whatever, that have changed the world, that have used their personal mission and values and vision to through business, make an impact. So I'm asking some of the world's most extraordinary people to join us and talk about, you know, the business of sport with Shaq. John Howard, the former Prime Minister, has agreed that'll be the business of politics. And you'll see some really interesting, extraordinary guests. We believe it's the cheapest, most cutting-edge way to build a global brand. And we know that other firms can't do it because they don't have the background that I have in interviewing people and doing things. We got really incredible feedback on the Shaq interview. And if you have a keen eye, you'll notice that I interviewed him in the format of our sort of financial advice system. So, you know, that's kind of some of the exciting things. I don't really talk much about this stuff publicly. I don't want anyone to, you know, pump up the share price. I'm not a promoter. I don't really give two hoots. I want it to trade at intrinsic value. We do have a very strong sense of what we're doing, and we're confident that we can execute over a long period of time. We're not sure what will happen today or tomorrow. On the balance of probabilities, we're confident that, you know, within a sort of risk framework of no risk, we're probably okay. If you see me go and buy a boat building business, be very concerned. I know nothing about boats. I'm not mechanical, so I don't know how to run a building business or anything like that. But if you see us just buying accounting firms between 0 and 10 million, be very confident that, you know, even if we get it, if we get a step wrong somewhere, we're pretty good on the hustle and the regather and we're very determined. So we will never give up, and we will make things right if we get bowled a curveball. Now, at the end of the day, life's a bit like cricket. This is not a good reference for US listeners, but you know, if you don't get out, you can keep scoring runs. And our focus is to not get out. We believe in extreme defense as the ultimate offense.
Love it. Well, Britt, thank you very much for your time. I know you've got to run. One final question. I mean, where can people go to learn more or follow along with what you and KPG are doing?
Yeah, so we're on the internet, kellypartners.com.au. You'll find the Kelly Partners Group website as well. And you'll find the Kelly Partners Scholars program website, which is worth having a look at. You'll find our YouTube channel. Don't follow my Instagram page because I get in trouble for just putting photos of a beach. But I do that for all my friends and clients, who most of my friends are clients, so they know where I am and what I'm up to. So if you don't have a sense of humor, maybe don't follow that. The owner's manual is at our group website, which is kellypartnersgroup.com.au. And, you know, genuinely, if you've got any questions, send them to Tom or send them to me. We love meeting people because we learn from people, and we frankly are humbled anytime anyone asks us a question about the business. That's why I answer the questions, Tom, because, you know, I don't think people realize how much they've taught us about ourselves and our own business by asking these questions. It's made the business better. And that's our mantra, you know, which is about being better off, like being focused on getting better every day.
Love it. Brett, thanks so much for your time, and we'll have to do this again one day.
Hey, Tom, thanks so much. I hope I'm the most interesting accountant you've met today. The heart of our business is not being boring.
Cool. Thanks, Britt.
Thanks, Jamie. I appreciate it.
Cheers.